Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Anders Halvorsen, and he'll be answering your most important questions on an entirely synthetic fish. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Anders a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Anders Halvorsen about an entirely synthetic fish. This segment of the show is brought to you by the Orvis Company, makers of fly rods in the USA since 1856, and still on the cutting edge with their award-winning Helos fly rods. Check out their premium quality flies like Copper Johns, Beadhead Princes, and Elk Hair Caddises, all for $1.50 each at www.orvis.com/flies. That's www.orvis.com/flies. Fill your fly box this season at an incredible price. Find out more about all the great fly fishing products Orvis has at www.orvis.com. That's www.orvis.com. Before we introduce Anders, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For a drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Anders' section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a copy of Anders' book, An Entirely Synthetic Fish. So here's how you can win Anders' book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Anders' book. Tonight our guest is Anders Halvorsen. Anders received his Ph.D. in ecology and conservation biology from Yale University in 2005. He received a grant from the National Science Foundation to examine freshwater fisheries management from that perspective. The result was the book, An Entirely Synthetic Fish, How Rainbow Trout Beguiled America and Overran the World. From the beginning, Anders' goal was to write a book in a way that would engage a broad audience, and in 2010 it won the National Outdoor Book Award and was a featured item in Outside Magazine's end-of-the-year issue. Anders is currently a research associate at the University of Colorado Center of the American West. He lives in Boulder, Colorado, with his wife and three sons. Anders, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you, and this is a little bit different for our audience. We so many times do shows on how to or where to or so forth, but we're going to get a little history lesson, I believe, from you tonight, and maybe a glimpse towards the future, I hope, and I think it'll be a lot of fun. You wrote the book, An Entirely Synthetic Fish, so it's probably appropriate, because everybody's probably wondering, what do you mean, synthetic fish? And Don in Clarksville, Tennessee, posed that question. He says, what is meant by the term synthetic fish? So let's start there.
Okay, well, yeah, that term is actually, it's a quote from a 1939 report from the manager of the Federal Fish Hatcheries. They wrote these reports every year to sort of justify what they were doing, and he was very proud to say that it was now, quote, it was now possible, or it is now possible, to create an entirely synthetic fish, such as game fish. And that quote really stuck with me, because the reason I sort of got into this book, I grew up fishing in Colorado, and I sort of dropped out of it after a while, I don't know when, but I just sort of stopped fishing without really thinking about it too much. And a few years later, I wound up working on my PhD, as you noted, and I began thinking about it a lot more. And I realized, I began to think about these fish. I was studying amphibians mostly, and amphibians have a big, fish, trout in particular, have a big impact on amphibians. They're fierce predators. And it made me start thinking about fishing and getting back out and why I had given up fishing. And it occurred to me that there was a real paradox, which is to say a lot of, like most fishermen, I used to go out fishing. It was my way of connecting with the natural world and of getting away from the industrial world, of getting away from civilization. And yet I began to sort of realize that a lot of the fish I was catching, especially here in Colorado, were very much a product of our industrial culture. These rainbow trout that I was catching here in Colorado are not native to Colorado, and many of them, most of them, are hatchery fish. In fact, 2 out of 3 fish swimming in Colorado's waters today are not native to Colorado, and many of them are rainbow trout, and they were introduced for the sake of recreational fishing. So it really struck me that there was sort of a paradox there, that fly fishermen like to think of themselves as getting out there and connecting to the natural world, and yet what's been done in the name of recreational fishing is sort of staggering. You hear a lot about what's going on with marine fisheries, and you hear a lot about what's going on with salmon, but you never really hear too much about freshwater fisheries. And there's some sort of amazing stories. So I began looking into that, and when I finished my PhD, I got a grant from the National Science Foundation to start looking into the history of freshwater fisheries management further, and really came across just these amazing stories that were connected to this fish. And that quote really stuck with me, because to me it said so much, not about the fish at all, but it says so much about us and our relationship to the natural world and how it's changed over the last 150 years and how it's stayed the same.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of this, you know, catching a rainbow trout in Colorado, we kind of take for granted. We just, you know, we kind of expect that there will be fish there, you know.
And, right, well, rainbow trout in particular, you know, they were our sort of unofficial state fish up until the mid-90s, and they were the official state fish of Utah until the mid-90s, and yet a lot of people don't realize that rainbow trout are native only to the Pacific Rim from Mexico up around, you know, on a narrow band along the coast there, up around through Alaska and all the way over to Kamchatka.
Right.
But they've been introduced every continent in the world and every state in the United States. You can even go catch rainbow trout in Hawaii now if you want.
My gosh. Well, let's kind of start at the beginning. This hasn't taken place. I mean, this has taken place, what, in the past 150 years?
Yes, that's about right.
The idea of raising fish farms and transporting them and stocking them. Why was this originally started, you know, at the beginning? And it started on the East Coast, didn't it?
Yeah, it started on the East Coast. And like I say, there are these sort of fascinating stories that go along with these fish. And the beginning is one of the most fascinating times of all. So you had, in the United States, the Industrial Revolution going on in the last few decades of the 19th century, and it had two very big effects, at least as far as this story is concerned. One, it created a sort of massive amount of wealth, particularly for the sort of white Anglo-Saxons who were running the show along the eastern seaboard. And two, it created a massive degradation of our waterways. So you had all the trees being cut down, you had agriculture, massive intensive agriculture, you had tanneries and factories using these rivers as sort of unchecked sewers, you had dams being built all over the place. And so the fisheries were truly just decimated up and down the East Coast. And that led to a crisis. Those two things in together created a crisis as far as many of the sort of elite upper crust Anglo-Saxons were concerned on the East Coast. There was a great quote that I came across. Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who was the father of the Supreme Court Justice and famous magazine columnist in his own right at the time, warned that, quote, such a set of black-coated, stiff-jointed, soft-muscled, paste-complexioned youth as we can boast in our Atlantic cities never before sprang from the loins of Anglo-Saxon lineage. So they were terrified that their children were turning into a bunch of fops, that they had to find a way to create manly men again, that if they didn't create manly men, virile men, democracy itself was at risk. So there's this fascinating character named George Perkins Marsh, who was credited today really with founding the environmental movement in this country. And he was commissioned by the state of Vermont to write a report about what to do about their fisheries. And he reached a similar conclusion as Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. about what was happening to the youth of the country. He warns that we're becoming, let me drag this quote, that we have become not merely a more, quote, not merely a more thoughtful and earnest, but it is to be feared, a duller as well as a more effeminate and less bold and spirited nation. So how does that all relate to where did fish stocking come from? Well, 15 years earlier in France, poor fishermen there had sort of rediscovered how to artificially propagate fish. And that knowledge had crossed the Atlantic, and George Perkins Marsh had heard about it, and he decided that was the solution. He said, there's no way we can regulate this industry that's creating such wealth for our country. There's no way we can, you know, stop producing dams or stop using these things as sewers, but we can go for this technological fix. We can artificially stock our streams with trout, and that'll get the boys out fishing again, and we'll have virile men, and democracy will be safe. And so his idea sort of got put on hold during the Civil War, but then after the Civil War, it really took off and is credited, is said by some to be the first sort of mass environmental movement that our country had.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that they were aware that they were polluting and contaminating the environment back then. And, you know, we look at that today and act like it's something new.
Well, George Perkins Marsh he wrote this book, Man and Nature, which was really the first book to look at that, the first one to say, hey, humans are actually having a broad impact on the environment. Up until that time, that was not on anybody's mind.
Yeah, it's, and I think in your book, too, you talked about they had kind of given up on getting men back into the hunting because they had chased all the animals out, all the big game, and that was like...
He said that was a lost cause.
Yeah.
We can't regain that, but we can at least get people out fishing again.
Yeah, interesting. So where were the first fish raised for stocking purposes for lakes and streams?
In the United States, the first fish were on the East Coast, and they were brook trout. And it was the first efforts were really by private individuals who were trying to make a profit. They would raise the fish in a hatchery somewhere, you know, in a rural area, and then ship them into New York and Boston. They made a pretty good profit at that initially. But where it really took off was with a man named Spencer Fullerton Baird, who was head of the Smithsonian Institution and just this very interesting and charismatic person. He was an extremely well-regarded scientist and naturalist, but also very savvy politically. And so the fisheries were declining up and down the East Coast, the marine fisheries, and Spencer Fullerton Baird convinced Congress to fund a one-year investigative body to look into why the fisheries were declining up and down the East Coast, specifically the SCUP off Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And he did his investigation, and it was a failure. He decided that the SCUP were disappearing because of there were too many traps on the estuaries where the fish were going up to spawn, and that they had to get rid of some of these fish traps or the fish themselves were going to get wiped out. Well, the next year, after he issued his report, there was a SCUP baby boom. There was just an overload of SCUP, and so he was discredited in terms of his investigation. And likewise, he had said, well, if you, the states, Massachusetts and Rhode Island, don't choose to regulate these traps yourselves, then the federal government is going to step in and do it. And the states called his bluff on that. They said the federal government doesn't have the will and probably not the authority to do something like that. And he had to admit they were right. So it was sort of a miserable failure. And that year, a group of people associated with the American Fish Culturalists Association, which later became the American Fisheries Society, which is the big fisheries management society in the United States today, came to him and they said, you know, we think that we've got to start the federal government needs to be the one that artificially propagates fish, and it'll make you extremely popular because you can produce more fish than anybody can imagine, so many that regulation of fishing is unnecessary. Because, of course, they say, you know, 99% of the fish that are spawned in the wild die, but if we do it in the hatcheries, we can, you know, 90% of them will survive, and then you put them in the river and people can catch them and there's no regulation involved, it's going to make you very popular. Well, he gets involved with that, and he convinces Congress to give him more funding to begin culturing fish, thanks to Robert Roosevelt, in fact, who was Teddy Roosevelt's uncle, who was a Congress member at the time. And the U.S. Fish Commission, within a couple of years, the U.S. Fish Commission has a huge budget dedicated almost entirely to fish hatcheries, to artificially propagating trout. And they start introducing shad. They try every sort of fish that you can imagine. They start introducing them around the country.
Yeah, when you said, you know, brook trout were one of the first, but, yeah, you mentioned shad were others. But when our poor fathers and mothers came to the East Coast, basically the brook trout was the only trout available on the East Coast. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. There were a few other varieties, but brook trout was the big one.
That was the big one. No rainbow trout, no brown trout.
That's right.
Mine today.
And, that's right.
So they started with brook trout and shad, you said. Were there any others that were first?
Well, the other big one that they were very interested in was Atlantic salmon. And salmon, like everything else, had been decimated. Relations with Canada were at a low ebb at that point, so they couldn't go north to get salmon eggs to restock the rivers of East Coast. So a guy, this fascinating character named Livingston Stone, convinced Baird to send him to California to get salmon from there. Of course, there are Pacific salmon there to get, but they didn't really think too much about that at the time, to get Pacific salmon to restock all of the rivers along the East Coast. And this is in the year 1872. And Livingston Stone is this, he was a minister in Charlestown, New Hampshire, and he lived a very staid life. He traced his lineage back to the Mayflower, and I don't think had too many adventures in his life. But somehow he quit the ministry and took up fish culture, and shortly thereafter convinced Baird to send him to California. And this is 1872, 3 years after the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. So still a very wild country. And he heads out there to try to find some salmon. And when he gets to California and starts asking around about where do the Pacific salmon spawn, everybody says, oh, they haven't spawned around here for years because California has decimated their fisheries because of hydraulic mining, where they would actually use a sort of huge fire hose and blast the hillsides away. At one point, the bed of the Sacramento River was going up by something like 6 feet per year. There was so much sediment being washed into it. But finally, he finds some railroad engineer who tells him he's seen the Indians catching fish up north on the McLeod, which is near Mount Shasta. So he makes his way up there he takes the train a little ways, and he gets on a stagecoach, then he just has to hike. And finally, he gets to this place. And the only reason and sure enough, there are salmon spawning there, and the only reason that river hasn't been destroyed is because the Wintu have killed or driven off every other white man that's tried to get a foothold there. But somehow this minister from New Hampshire convinces them to let him set up a hatchery there. And he does so, and he has, the adventures that he has are just amazing. And he wrote these all up in reports for the U.S. Fish Commission. They're all available online, actually. And he starts shipping Pacific salmon back east. And for 7 years, he collects and ships salmon back east, and they stock them up and down the East Coast and even in some interior water bodies. And they have no luck. There's not a single run of Pacific salmon on the East Coast. So he and Baird start talking about what to do, and rather than abandon this whole thing, they start talking about actually culturing this other fish that they found out there, which is rainbow trout. And Baird is savvy enough to know that most of the members of Congress are sportsmen and that this will be very popular with them. And he's heard from some others who have done some experiments with rainbow trout that rainbow trout are hardier, they're easier to raise in hatcheries, they can withstand warmer temperatures, they can withstand more sediment in the stream. So they start experimenting with them and find all of these things are true. And within a few years, they've shipped rainbow trout to 33 out of 38 states then in the nation. So rainbow trout really just took off, and that's where it all began.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, Anders. When we come back, we'll talk more about how this moved throughout the nation and the world. Cortland Line Company recognizes the rapidly expanding market for the precise nymphing methods pioneered by the European competitive angling community. Czech, French, and Spanish nymphing styles increase productivity by keeping anglers in close contact with their flies. Extra long, light action rods and unique rigging are the rule for this type of fishing, but standard taper floating lines are often a hindrance. Cortland Line has been developing, testing, and perfecting the ultimate taper configuration to empower nymph fishermen using these new methods, and our new competition nymph line is finally ready for release. Look for the competition nymph line to be available this summer from Cortland. Your nymph rod has met its match. For more information on Cortland lines, visit www.cortlandline.com. That's www.cortlandline.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Anders Halvorsen about an entirely synthetic fish. If you'd like to ask Anders a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, now you, I think you completed your book last year. Was it 2010?
It was published in 2010. I completed it in 2009.
Okay. So you spent quite a bit of time and research on that. And you have a website kind of devoted to the book. Do you want to share that with people so they know where to find it?
Sure.
Find the book and find out
it
more?
Should be pretty easy. It's AndersHalvorsen.com. So that's AndersHalvorsen.com.
Okay, AndersHalvorsen.com, and they can read a little bit more about your book and, I guess, order it online there if they'd like.
You can order it there. It'll direct you to other places. It's got a lot of pictures. There's some amazing pictures that I dug up with relation to this whole story, and I wasn't able to include all of them in the book, so I put them online there, as well as some of the primary sources that I used for it. And then there are places where you can go link through to get a book. You know, I would encourage people to go to their local fly shop or their local bookstore to pick it up, but you can also find other opportunities there.
Good, good. Well, good. Well, we've got, and this is, of course, we're going to get questions like this. We've got one online here from Harold Sinclair in New York. And he says, and I guess this is something we all think about, he says, is it correct for man to engineer fisheries and plant fish annually just for the sake of sport fishing? Sport fishing by itself seems trivial compared to maintaining natural environments without introducing false or previously non-existent animal populations. And then he has ... In other words, what's your take on that?
Well, I think it's a really fascinating question, and once again, one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I was sort of plagued by that question myself. And one of the things that, you know, I don't know if I can provide a comprehensive answer here, but I'll provide at least something. One of the things that really fascinated me by the time I had finished this book and looked not just at all the things that we did in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, to spread and try to engineer these fisheries, but then I looked at everything that's being done today to restore native fish, and there's a lot being done. And one thing that really struck me was sort of how similar the rhetoric is from what you hear today about restoring native fish and what people said 100 years ago. It's both sets of people are sure they're doing the right thing for the world. And I guess I would just encourage everybody who's involved with sort of native fish restoration to, I'm a proponent of it. I think it's terrific, not just from a moral standpoint and even an economic standpoint. But I would encourage everybody to have a certain sense of humility, because whatever we're doing now, Lord knows what they're going to say in 100 years about all the mistakes that we've made. The one that comes to mind in particular is our focus on, quote, native fish. You know, what's going to happen here? And when climate change has shifted distributions all over the place, I think that whole paradigm may be in for a little shaking up here soon. So it's hard to say what they're going to think about what we're doing now.
Yeah, it is a real dilemma, because most of us who love fishing, especially fly fishing, because I think we feel like we're even a little closer to nature than maybe the hardware guys, but you know, things change. I read that book about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and in that book they were talking about being up in the, I think it was the Bitterroot Mountains in Idaho, and when they were there, they were like at 8,000, 8,500 feet, and they almost starved to death because there were no big game animals at that altitude. All the big game animals were down below on the plain. Well, that's not the case today. You know, we've pushed all the animals up into the higher altitudes, and that's now where he was is a big game, you know, the big game are thriving in that area. But back then, they weren't even there. They were all lower in altitude. So, you know, yeah, with the climate change and population, no matter what we do to preserve it, it's bound to change in one way, shape, or form. Doesn't mean we don't have to try that. Not, I mean, we do have to try to preserve it. Otherwise, we'd have nothing right now, which would be sad.
And that was another discovery that I think people did make in the 1960s. You know, just the same time that we had political upheaval and cultural upheaval in the 1960s, there was also a scientific revolution going on within ecology and many other fields with the rise of chaos theory. And essentially, you may have heard this anecdote before, but there was a meteorologist who had a very complex model that he was running on the computer, and he stopped it, and he wrote down all the parameters for it. He was watching weather patterns, wrote down all these parameters to 10 decimal places. And then he went back and he ran it again, and then he went back and he plugged those parameters in again and ran the model again and came up with a completely different results. And I guess the point of that is that no matter what you try to do or how determinist and how precise you try to be about modifying something in science, the results are going to be completely unpredictable, and that's particularly true in the natural world, I think, where up until the 1960s, I think most people, most managers, believed that they could manage and engineer ecosystems to whatever we wanted them to be. And after the 1960s, that was no longer the case. Everybody recognized, or not everybody, but many recognized that things are very unpredictable, whatever you try to do out there.
Yeah, it really is, and you know, even on a small scale, like, you know, I live up in the mountains in Colorado, and on my property last year, we cut down 42 large pine trees off the property just to make the other trees healthier and to mitigate against, you know, fire situations. And, you know, even that little thing, you know, I wonder, what did you just do?
Right.
to try to save your house by cutting down these trees. And you think you're making everything more healthy, but are you? And, you know, I mean, you're right. It's unpredictable, totally. But and what's interesting, too, is that with the fisheries, we're putting fish into the environment to please us as sports men and women and kids and teaching them how to fish. And so, and yet other sports like deer hunting in many areas is there to cull out the excess. You know, it's almost the total opposite approach of managing wildlife. They're not putting deer into the woods. They're having people hunt them to get them out of the woods because they're, you know, they're overgrazing and overpopulating their area. So it's kind of a different, totally different situation.
Well, right. But the deer, at least the conventional wisdom, which I think can be questioned. But anyway, the conventional wisdom with deer is that we've gotten rid of all the predators, right? So that we changed that ecosystem pretty radically 50, 100 years ago. So now we're dealing with the consequences of that.
Yeah, we're replacing the wolves, right?
Yeah.
Coyotes and so forth, so to speak.
That's right.
Well, now, getting back to the fish and the stocking, you said that, you know, they brought, first they tried to do some Atlantic salmon, you know, development out there, and that didn't work, right?
And then, they tried to replace the Atlantic salmon with Pacific salmon.
Oh, they didn't actually try to do Atlantic on their own, then. Okay. I misunderstood that. So then when the Pacific were brought in, did they go out to sea and just never come back, or just not go out to sea, or just die?
I don't think anybody really has any idea why they failed. They simply disappeared. They put them in at a very small stage, as fry usually, because it was easier to transport. It was a very different paradigm back then. You know, today we think of stocking, we think of catch and we think of put and take fisheries where you're stocking quarter pound fish, 8-inch rainbows into the streams. Back then it was a completely different goal. Their goal was not to provide a put and take fishery with these things. It was to introduce these fish as far and wide as possible, as Spencer Baird once said. And so what they would do is just introduce them as fry, and as long as a few of them made it and set up a self-sustaining population, they considered that a success. So it was a completely different goal. So they would have been dropping these things in as fry, and I think they just never saw them again. Did they make it to sea, or did they just die within a few days? I don't know the answer to that.
That would have been an interesting change to the environment. That would have worked. Who knows? Yeah. Were there any other successes or failures? I know we're going to talk about
that. Oh, yeah. They had so there was a whole movement at the time called the acclimatizing movement. And it had first taken root in England and France because they had these vast overseas empires and were having these great experiments, sort of grand old time, trying to swap wildlife as far and wide as they could. It wasn't domestic species. They were just trying to swap wildlife. And they considered that to be, you know, doing it, like I was saying, the best thing for the world. And this was the age that it was the same thing with fisheries, that we swapped fish all over the country, fish and other birds. There was a famous drug magnate, not in the mafioso sense, but a pharmaceutical captain of industry in New York City who decided that Americans were going to be culturally impoverished if we didn't have every species of bird mentioned in Shakespeare. So he brought over every species, and starlings were one of them. They're mentioned in Henry V, I think. I'll get the play wrong. But anyway, they're mentioned in one line in a Shakespeare play. And consequently, we have starlings all over the country today, all because of this one guy. And it was the same thing with fish. We swapped them. Shad are a classic example. We swapped them up and down and all through the country. And carp are another big example that Spencer Fullerton Baird really thought he was doing a service to the country by bringing German carp over and spreading them around. And then actually carp became very unpopular, as most people know, within a few decades and remained unpopular for many years. And now they're sort of having a comeback, as you,
right.
You probably know.
Yeah. Very interesting sport fish now.
It was a big industry. And in fact, the first people to artificially propagate rainbow trout, it wasn't Livingston Stone. It was a group called the Ornithological and Piscatorial Acclimatizing Society of California. And their goal was to introduce all the fish and birds from the east and from the more cultured places around the world into California. And they just happened to mess around a little bit with these rainbow trout they found in their backyard, shipped them east to some folks in New York, Seth Green, who's a famous fish culturalist in New York, and that was where rainbow trout first got started. So that was a big movement. So they were trying everything that they could. Brown trout, of course, were sent over.
With no concern about how it might affect the environment at that time, I guess it just wasn't knowledge they had.
It wasn't on their mind. They didn't think in terms of native fish versus non-native fish or native anything versus non-native things. And that thinking, I think, really persisted up once again until the 1960s. So I'll talk about this. In 1962, right up until 1962, I think that thinking that nobody thought about what was native and what was non-native was here. And in the 1950s, people began doing experiments with using rotenone, which is a fish poison, to kill all the fish out of these watersheds so that they could introduce more desirable fish. And it culminated in 1962 when Wyoming Game and Fish and Utah Fish and Game and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided to poison the Green River above Flaming Gorge. That's a watershed that's 15,000 square miles. That's the size of Connecticut and Massachusetts combined. It's really the headwaters of the Colorado River in southwestern Wyoming. And they decided to use this fish poison to kill all of the native and non-native fish that were in that watershed. And in fact, it also kills the invertebrates that are in there, so that it would be safe for them to introduce rainbow trout. Remember, rainbow trout are not native to Wyoming. They wanted to bring them in and introduce them and create this incredible rainbow trout fishery. Part of the reason they got the idea was because the Bureau of Reclamation was going to build a dam in Flaming Gorge and upstream in Fontanelle that would really change the river from what had been a sort of muddy, torrential river in the spring and a sort of warm trickle in the late summer to a cold, clear, consistent river that would be ideal for these trout. So they decided that they were going to go through with this. And when I started looking into this, I was sort of flabbergasted by this, and I thought, well, I'll just go, down to the microfilm and look at the Denver Post for September 1962 and find all these stories. And I couldn't find a thing about it. All the stories about this event were buried in the sports section. And the only thing that they said was this fishing is going to be great in Wyoming when we've wiped out all these fish and introduced rainbow trout. And it's just sort of so hard to conceive of that today. And the only reason that got on the radar screen, well, there were some opponents to this thing, Robert Miller and Carl Hubbs, who were two ichthyologists of the day, and they were the first ones to publish an article about native fish in the fisheries journals. And they were just astounded by what the Wyoming Game and what these departments were going to do. And they declare, Wyoming Game and Fish and the federal agencies are brainwashing Americans by dividing the world into coarse trash fish and game fish. And that was the division that people made. It wasn't native fish versus non-native fish. And Miller and Hubbs tried their hardest to get the newspapers, to even get the environmental groups to get riled up about this project and try to stop it, and nobody took it. No newspapers carried the story. None of the environmental groups got on it. And so this project went ahead, and they poisoned that entire watershed that I was describing in September 1962. And then two things happened. First of all, Bureau of Reclamation couldn't close the dam in time. They were going to just let the rotenone build up behind the dam and naturally oxidize and detoxify there. But Bureau of Reclamation decided they couldn't close the dam in time. So they had to let the water go down. The rotenone would get downstream. So they set up on a bridge along the Green River in Colorado to pour in this detoxicant, and it didn't work. A lot of the poison got downstream. And dead and dying fish wind up in Dinosaur National Monument. That's just 16 miles downstream from where they were trying to detoxify this stuff. And Dinosaur National Monument, so two things. First of all, dinosaur had become a sort of national emblem, a hallowed ground for Americans because of the efforts of the Sierra Club a few years earlier, who had successfully blocked the building of a dam there thanks to this brilliant PR campaign where they put these ads in the newspapers and convinced Americans that our national parks were our national heritage, that they were the cathedrals of America, and that they shouldn't be harmed. And second of all, Rachel Carson just happened to come out with Silent Spring within a month or two of that of this event. And Silent Spring transfixed America and changed everybody's attitude towards chemicals in the environment. And so it became this sort of 1-2 punch, and it blew up. Here we were dumping chemicals into these rivers, and they were poisoning fish in our cathedrals. And it absolutely blows up. And Stuart Udall, who's the new Secretary of Interior under Kennedy, starts getting a lot of heat from Congress and elsewhere, from the public. And he begins this review of the operation, and in his review he writes that from now on, whenever there's a threat to a unique species from any operation, that has to be a dominant priority, a dominant consideration in the evaluation of the project. And that doesn't seem like very much now. That just seems par for the course. But at the time, that was really revolutionary. And in fact, he went on to create a committee to examine threatened and endangered species in the United States. And that committee produced a list of threatened and endangered species that eventually led to the early versions of the Endangered Species Act in 1966 and 1969, and ultimately to the Endangered Species Act of 1973. And, of course, we've now spent more than $100 million under that act trying to restore the native fish of the Green River. So it's this sort of circular thing. But that was the event, and there was there's a very direct connection there between rainbow trout, the Endangered Species Act, and the attitudes we have today towards native versus non-native. Up until 1962, it was all coarse fish versus game fish. Nobody thought in terms of native versus non-native.
And the trout always had its elitist status with gentlemen fly fishers, right?
I mean, oh, yeah, of course, going all the way back to Walton, right?
Yeah, the trout was the premier fish, the trout and the salmon. So, yeah, interesting. And now the Green River there below Framing Gorge is a world-class.
Well, yeah, there was a success in that way, right? It's amazing fishery now.
But all you have to do is go, like you say, about 15 miles downstream, and then it turns back into its natural Green River when it goes through Dinosaur, which is just pretty
cool. Well, it's still cold and clear, which is not what it used to be, right? Because it's water coming out of the dam.
Yeah. It takes it a while to get back to its normal status, but yeah, it's interesting how that whole river changes. I floated that from Flaming Gorge all the way down through the Grand Canyon, almost every mile of that.
That's a great trip.
But, it changes drastically all the way back and forth. Interesting how that has changed that native species. I know the regulation out of Glen Canyon Dam is partly due to, the flows out of there are partly due to trying to have flows that are, that will support the native fish in the Grand Canyon as well, because it's the same situation,
Right.
And so now they're trying to flush and, control it, make it like it's natural, and of course that's who knows if that's a winning or losing battle. But
yeah, it's a tall order.
Yeah. Okay, well, we need to take another quick break here, and then we'll come back. We'll dig more into this very interesting history about the rainbow trout. Visit the Trout Spot on the web at www.thetroutspot.com for your entire fly fishing needs. At thetroutspot.com, we carry a large selection of premium flies and fly assortments with prices ranging at just 75 cents each. Looking for something for your vest or lanyard? Check out our selection of tackle and accessories from leading manufacturers at www.thetroutspot.com. At thetroutspot.com, we also have a wide variety of books and videos as well as gifts and home decor items. All items are in stock and usually ship within 24 hours. Shipping on all fly-only orders are just $2.69. Our knowledgeable staff looks forward to helping you have a great fly fishing experience. Visit us on the web at www.thetroutspot.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Anders Halvorsen about an entirely synthetic fish. If you'd like to ask Anders a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, back to the old days here, Anders, when the processes and the facilities that they used to use to harvest eggs and raise fish, what did they do back then, and has it changed much since then, and how has it changed?
Actually, it's changed surprisingly little. So as part of this book, I actually went and propagated some. The Colorado Division of Wildlife was kind enough to let me come visit their hatchery and help propagate some trout, and then I sort of followed them through the system up until they were stocked into a reservoir. And it's changed very little. It was the same process. You get a pan, you squeeze out the eggs out of the ripe females, you squeeze out some milk from the males, and you know the fertilization is almost instant when you swirl, when you mix that around. Raise that up in, you know, increasingly large containers, first very small containers. You let the eggs, get to, and then the hatchlings, and then the fry. And it's amazing how the process has changed. It's almost identical to what that French fisherman described in the 1840s in France. It's the same process, except for perhaps the scale. You know, the scale at which we do this today is pretty staggering. We stock something like 100 million, just rainbow trout alone, we stock 100 million rainbow trout weighing 25 million pounds every year. And, you know, the number of fish we stock is in the billions. Walleye are actually the fish that we stock the most of, but we stock them at a tiny size, so the effort that goes into them is much smaller than what goes into rainbow trout. By weight, most of the fish we stock are rainbow trout.
And then in walleye second, you're saying?
Not even second. I don't even know by weight. It would be rainbow trout and then, you know, salmon, of course. And walleye, we stock hundreds of millions of them, but they're as fry, so the weight is negligible. So it's not considerable in terms of the weight of fish stock. In terms of the pounds of fish stock, rainbow trout are the king.
Now, I think I remember reading in your book you had talked about there is some high-tech aspects of egg selection nowadays that have back then, right?
Yeah, well, you know, they're an inventive crowd, these guys, and one of the things they have is a little LED and a Ferris wheel that sort of, when the eggs die, if they're not viable, they're a different color, they're a white color, and so they have a little Ferris wheel that goes around picking up these eggs a few days after they've been fertilized, and it picks up the egg, and the eye checks it out to see if it's white or a good, healthy salmon color, and if it's white, a blast of air comes from one side and shoots the dead egg off to one side. And if it's the right color, a blast of air comes from the other side and shoots it off the other direction. So they do some creative and innovative things like that. But by and large, the process is amazingly similar to what it was so long ago.
Now, back in the 1800s, when they were first doing this on the railroads and so forth, how were they transported? And were they transporting eggs or were they transporting fry or both?
It was both. But frequently, so originally, well, it was always on the railroad. And as they realized what a proposition they had here, they started creating actual fish cars. The U.S. Fish Commission built, I don't know, 5 or 6 fish cars, special fish cars for transporting these things all over the country. And the way it would work, as I was saying, Baird was this very politically savvy man. And so they offered, the U.S. Fish Commission would send anybody who wanted fish, the U.S. Fish Commission would send you fish to stock in your local waterway. The only demand that they made was that you not send your request straight to the Fish Commission. You had to send your request through your congressman. So congressmen were besieged with these requests for fish, and of course that was just a brilliant way for the Fish Commission to demonstrate how important they were to Americans. And Baird, I have a lot of respect for Baird, but he could be a little bit cynical about this sometimes. So there's a letter in Washington, D.C. in the National Archives from Baird in which he says, in this letter always, I think about this one a lot, he's writing to a subordinate who had complained that the eggs that had been requested by some group, there's no way that they were going to survive in the waterway that they planned to introduce them to. And Baird writes back to this subordinate, he writes, "It does not make much difference what Rockwood does with the salmon eggs," he declares. "The object is to introduce them into as many different states as possible and to have credit with Congress accordingly. If they are there, they are there. We can so swear, and that is the end of it." So it was just this massive campaign to spread these fish as far and wide as possible. And the way it would work is you'd send your request through your congressman to the Fish Commission. They would get it. A few days before they were going to ship it out, they would send you a telegram. And you would meet them at the train station with some milk cans, and they would drop the fry, usually, sometimes the eggs, give you the fry or the eggs, and you would go stock them into your local waterway. So it was this grand, massive project that we had to introduce fish all over the country.
And all free.
All free, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. now it's kind of expensive. If you want to stock your own little lake, you got to pay.
Yeah, you got to pay, and you got to get all sorts of permits and all of that, right?
Yeah, yeah. Now, going back to the trout that existed in the United States before stocking, what trout were actually, I mean, you said that the rainbow were native to and wild along the West Coast from Mexico up to Kamchatka.
That's right.
The brook trout were wild on the East Coast. What about cutthroat and some of the other species that we know, like golden trout, greenback? Are those native?
Well, yes, certainly. So the cutthroat trout are really the interior western. Most people think of them as the interior western native trout. And they're native, you know, up and down the Rocky Mountains, let's say. And all the way, actually, there's coastal varieties of them as well. So from the coast all the way into the Rocky Mountains and over the Continental Divide in some places. And then, of course, you had the brook trout, which were up and down the East Coast and well and east to the Great Lakes. And then you have other varieties. You've got, you know, of course, the lake trout and you know, grayling, bull trout, sort of scattered around the northern ends of the country.
But brown trout wasn't indigenous to the United States either, was it?
Brown trout is not. Brown trout, we got brown trout both from Germany and from Scotland.
Okay.
And it was one of these exchanges. We sent them rainbow trout, which actually had some ramifications later on, which maybe we can talk about with whirling disease. We sent them rainbow trout and any other and lots of other fish, and they sent us brook trout.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not, sorry. They sent us brown trout.
Brown trout, yeah. And the other aspect of the rainbow comes into play with the steelhead, right? Because we're still talking about a rainbow trout here, but a rainbow trout that goes to sea. And I know
That's
we're
right.
Trying to get into the genetics here, but was there any attempt at introducing those on the East Coast? To get steelhead runs on the
East Coast? Well, yeah. I don't know about steelhead on the East Coast, but obviously they did it in the Great Lakes. Those were
right.
All introduced.
Right.
That's an interesting question, and I can't tell you. I would be shocked, frankly, if they didn't. And actually, a lot of the original rainbows, you know, we still don't fully comprehend what makes one fish a rainbow and one fish a steelhead. They're both the same species, and in fact, they frequently interbreed. So we still don't fully understand the genetic component of that. So when they first captured rainbow trout and brought them into the hatcheries to propagate, a lot of them were actually steelhead. So they actually had a big migratory problem with the rainbows. The rainbows were looked down on for some, well, one of their less desirable traits in the early years was that you'd put them in your private waterway and they would migrate out of there pretty quickly. So they were a very migratory fish. And that may be related to the fact that they had a lot of the steelhead genes in them.
We got a question here on the internet from Joel in Sheridan, Wyoming. He says, how far inland are the rainbow trout native, and how closely related are rainbow and cutthroat?
Okay, so the rainbow and cutthroat are very closely related, and that leads to some problems. The rainbow, the furthest inland that they get is in western Montana and the Kootenai. Mostly they're restricted to the coastal streams, but they do get inland to some degree. That's pretty far. They've gotten a ways if they've gotten all the way to Montana. But they were both, the rainbows and the cutthroats split from each other a few million years ago. And then the cutthroats invaded through the Columbia first. And then the topography sort of shifted and created these barrier falls. So when the rainbows, who had evolved in a little bit further south, came up and started to come in the Columbia, they couldn't get as far into the, as far east. But nevertheless, they're very closely related and can easily interbreed when they're in the same place. And that creates a big, that's one of the biggest problems with our introductions of rainbow trout. I don't know if you want to talk about that now or wait a little bit.
Well, no, you can talk. That brings in a cutbow, I take it.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
So what are some of those ramifications that...
Well, so one of the biggest problems with the numbers of rainbow trout that we've introduced over the last 150 years is that they hybridize so easily with the cutthroats. And so cutthroats throughout the West are in some cases extinct or very close to extinct and in some cases endangered because, not because they're disappearing, but because they're being hybridized out of existence. And that's happened to all the different subspecies of cutthroat. They've all been hit hard by this hybridization problem.
Mm. And it's so, natural. Yeah, hybridization, yeah.
Yeah, so you get these interesting conundrums, like in Montana right now, they're really struggling with what to do about the West Slope cutthroat, which is the native cutthroat to much of Montana and the northern Rockies. The rainbows have hybridized with so many populations of West Slope cutthroat that they used to be the most widespread cutthroat of all the cutthroat subspecies. Now, if you were to look for truly pure West Slope cutthroats, you'd find they only occupy about 2% of their original range. Most of the West Slope cutthroats that are out there now are hybrids. And that raises these really sticky questions about what to do under the Endangered Species Act. So if the primary threat to these West Slope cutthroat is hybridization with rainbows, then you have to consider, do you only count the purebred West Slope cutthroat as West Slopes and count the hybrids as their primary threat? If so, you're in a real trouble, because a lot of these West Slope cutthroat now, the purebreds, are restricted to these very high isolated headwater streams, where the populations are so small that inbreeding and other factors could quickly lead to extinction. So at the same time that you've got their primary threat being these hybrid West Slope rainbows, hybrid West Slope rainbows may be their only salvation as well, because they can reintroduce some vigor to the populations through interbreeding and or simply rescue the populations from going extinct. So it's this real conundrum that nobody knows how to handle under the Endangered Species Act, this ongoing and sort of contentious debate that's going on about that right now.
Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas asks, why do rainbow trout species get used more in stocking programs than any other trout species?
Yeah, so rainbows, so first of all, remember that the reason we're stocking all these fish is to create manly men. And rainbows are great fighters, and they recognized that a long time ago, that the rainbows were spectacular, the way they leap in the air, the way they fight. So first of all, they're great fish for producing virile men. But second of all, for whatever reason, rainbows thrive in hatcheries in a way that the other fish don't. And they're just very hardy fish. So they thrive in the hatcheries, and they thrive when you release them in conditions where other fish can't make it as well, for example, the brook trout. So they thrive in those conditions. Another reason is that they're sort of the Goldilocks of fish in terms of catchability. That, you know, the cutthroats, for example, are very opportunistic feeders, and so they'll strike at just about anything. And if you were to try to base a fishery around cutthroats, it could get fished out very quickly. Browns, on the other hand, are a little more cautious and can be frustrating frequently for beginning anglers, for example. And rainbows are sort of right in the middle there. They strike enough to give everybody some satisfaction, but they don't get fished out quite as easily as, say, the cutthroat would. So they're popular for all of those reasons.
Okay. Now, I think you mentioned earlier that the first rainbows that came out of California came out of McLeod River operations.
Yeah, technically the very first rainbow trout to be cultivated and shipped somewhere else were actually from around the San Francisco Bay Area by the California Acclimatizing Society.
Okay.
But the fish from the McLeod, you can probably trace the lineage of every rainbow trout you catch today to fish that were cultivated on the McLeod by Livingston Stone back in the 1870s.
Wow.
Because they shipped those, once the federal government got involved, it became a huge operation. And they shipped those fish. Within a few years, they had been shipped to 33 out of 38 states. Those states took some of them and established breeding programs and started mixing them around. So that's not to say that every fish is predominantly or in any way, you know, exclusively the domain of the McLeod, but probably you can find some genes in there that come from fish that Livingston Stone originally propagated on the McLeod.
Now, you had just mentioned what the effect of introduction of rainbows on the cutthroat the trout is, and Martin Coleman, again in Kansas, asks, what effects do they generally have on wild fish numbers? Do they affect even rainbow natives? Well,
yes,
when we say natives, they're the only native rainbow on the West Coast, right? So,
you mean wild. So you've got to draw the distinction between wild fish and native fish, right? And wild fish are technically any fish that was spawned in the wild. So
Right. Most
rainbows that are in any self-sustaining population and are not in the West Coast are wild, non-native fish. And so what effect do hatchery fish on wild fish have? Is, yes, they have a huge effect. Once again, this is a sort of interesting story. One of the first places they really worked this out was in Montana. And what the hypothesis is, what the discovery was that when you, up for a long time, they just sort of thought by adding hatchery fish, they were just adding a little cream on the top to the fishery that was there, so that there were just a few more fish for people to catch. But it turns out that hatchery fish have very different traits, both probably genetically and certainly from what they learn while they're growing up in the hatchery, from any wild fish. They, first of all, a shadow over the water usually means somebody's coming to feed them some pellets. And second of all, it pays to be, there's sort of no, so instead of a shadow being a threat from an osprey or a grizzly bear or something like that, shadows mean food. So they flock to these shadows. And second of all, they become very aggressive in these hatchery situations. And so you take these fish and you dump a whole bunch of them into a river where there's a thriving wild population. And the wild fish are very conservative in terms of how they spend their energy. So they'll find a hold and sit there, and they don't fight it out. It's usually the hierarchy is established pretty clearly just based on size, probably. And so the biggest fish gets the best hold and on down the way. Well, these hatchery fish understand the etiquette, and so they come in and start nipping and fighting with the wild fish and driving them out of these holds and causing them to burn a lot more energy than they otherwise would have because they've disrupted the entire hierarchy. And so these wild fish get driven out, and before you know it, the hatchery fish can't survive for long in the wild because they get picked off by the ospreys or they waste all of their energy and they don't have this constant food source like they're used to in the hatcheries. So most hatchery fish die off within a few months or less. And in the meantime, they've wreaked havoc on the wild fish population. So by the 2 or 3 months later, you've decimated the wild fishery, and the fishery's much worse off than it was before you stocked those fish. And then, of course, you know what happens next is everybody screams there's no fish in the river, so you stock even more fish. And so it becomes this cycle where you become completely dependent on stocked fish.
We need to take a quick break again, Anders, and when we come back, we'll finish up with talking about rainbow trout and how they affected America and the world. Front Range Angler is a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Anders Halvorsen about an entirely synthetic fish. If you'd like to ask Anders a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Now, we did get a question from Lanford Pritchett in Colorado. He asked, fish primarily on the Arkansas River, what is the origin of the rainbow in this area? And I think that's what you just said, is it's probably from the Cloud River operations, right?
Yeah, well, once again, you got to be careful. So that we mixed so many rainbow trout around. So the McLeod was the first real operation, but then they moved north up into Oregon and Washington and began collecting them from all over the place and mixing these strains up and interbreeding them, trying to create new strains to the point that now we have a huge number of different strains of rainbow trout, all of which have different names. And so I definitely want to make it clear that I'm not saying most or all rainbow trout are predominantly from the McLeod. They're from all over the place. We've mixed all the different natural strains together and created all sorts of new strains, and it's very hard to trace their lineage in any effective way. So Colorado had a fish, a rainbow trout, that had become wild in the Colorado River. It was called the Colorado River Rainbow, and that became the sort of gold standard for Colorado Division of Wildlife hatcheries, and that's the one that they usually went to. They have a couple of other varieties, but the Colorado River Rainbow is a strain that they've worked a lot with. And that's what they stocked. My guess is that that's what they were stocking in the Arkansas up until a few years ago, but that changed with whirling disease. So whirling disease hit fisheries, rainbow trout in particular, in Colorado very hard, as everybody probably knows. And Colorado took this approach. I was saying that we shipped rainbow trout over to Germany 100 years ago in exchange for some of their brown trout. Well, Colorado, 5-10 years ago, discovered that there was somebody working with rainbow trout from Germany who had found a strain that was highly resistant to whirling disease. And so Colorado went over and got some of these fish. They're called the Hofer rainbows, which are highly resistant to whirling disease, and crossed them with Colorado River cutthroat in the hatchery, and then recently introduced them into the Arkansas and to many other watersheds around the state.
You said cutthroat, but you meant rainbow.
I meant rainbow, sorry. Colorado River rainbows and Hofer rainbows were crossed and have been introduced. Mm-hmm. The idea is trying to sort of, once again, engineer a new fishery that's resistant to whirling disease.
where did whirling disease come from? And I know it was propagated in the hatcheries extensively. What's the story behind that?
So the guess is that it was brought over. So whirling disease is from Europe. And the guess is that it was brought over in some sort of frozen fish food or something like that many decades ago. And it got established in the hatcheries, especially in the East. And it became that it never really caused any problems in the wild. And even in the hatcheries, it wasn't really a big deal. They sort of learned how to manage around it. So whirling disease was around as a hatchery problem for quite a while. And then it somehow got to Colorado a few decades later, got into the hatchery, Colorado and Montana as well, got into the hatcheries and was introduced throughout the state from the state hatchery program. And for whatever reason, it had decimated for the first time, you know, in people's experience with this disease, it decimated the wild trout and got established in these streams and absolutely wiped out the fishery. So it's a very complicated, people are still trying to figure out what drives it, why it would have been such a scourge in Colorado's waterways and didn't affect others. It's a complex parasite that has two hosts, the tubifex, which is a little worm, underwater worm, aquatic worm, and the rainbow and trout. And it goes from one to another back and forth during its life cycle. And there's all sorts of things that could be determining that. The productivity of the stream, the actual variety of tubifex that's in the water. There's been a ton of research that's gone on this, and it all just keeps basically saying this thing is a very complicated, trying to understand what's happening here.
Yeah. Now, we had several questions about the genetics and triploids and so forth, so let's talk about that. Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas asks, are there genetic manipulations going on to help produce new species of trout that would replace the popularity of rainbows, really new fish?
Yeah, it's sort of scary what people are doing these days. So there's a lot of, I don't know about new species of fish, but they're doing some sort of interesting or maybe even scary things with genetics these days. Originally, when I started looking into this, I found a story about a group in one university that was feeding their rainbow trout creatine, which is the same bodybuilding supplement that Mark McGuire used in the home run derby and many other bodybuilders use. And they were feeding these rainbow trout creatine, and quote, because they thought, you know, fishermen would pay a premium for a harder fighting fish. And so that's where it got started, and now they've taken it up to a whole new level, and there's a group, is it in Rhode Island? I think it's in Rhode Island, where they've actually genetically modified these rainbow trout. They knocked out this myostatin, which inhibits muscle growth. And so these fish, if you look, just Google myostatin and rainbow trout, and you'll see some images that will, don't do it when you're eating your breakfast. It's unbelievable. These fish have these, they're sort of six-pack abs rippling down their sides.
And, how do you spell myostatin?
M-Y-O-S-T-A-T-I-N. And you'll find some shocking photos. And so they're starting to actually start to genetically modify these things. They say it's for the aquaculture industry, but Lord knows what's going to happen there. And then, of course, you've got the so-called frankenfish, which is this salmon that they're proposing to create that actually is genetically modified. They've actually taken genes from an ocean, taken DNA from a pout, which is a deep ocean fish, and Chinook salmon, and introduced it into an Atlantic salmon. And they've created this fish that grows twice as fast as a conventional Atlantic salmon so that they can bring it to market twice as fast. And they claim that this is never going to escape into the wild, that they've got, you know, big fences and they're going to make the fish sterile. But as
one
we were
hurricane.
Saying, you never know what's going to happen in this world when you start messing around with this stuff. So that's another route that these things are going. So I'm afraid to say that we do seem to be going towards genetically modifying these fish, and I wouldn't be surprised in a few decades if some aren't out in the wild somewhere.
Well, there were several questions. I won't do each of them here, but what about the triploid rainbow? What is a triploid?
Okay, so a triploid has an extra set of chromosomes, and consequently, they're infertile. They can't reproduce. And because of that, that's attractive. Fisheries managers have started playing with creating these triploid fish for two reasons. First of all, it avoids this problem of hybridization. So you can introduce these rainbow trout and you don't have to worry about them actually hybridizing with cutthroats, for example. But the other, and maybe the primary reason that people are interested in triploids is because these fish aren't They don't sexually, they don't have any sex drive. They don't mature sexually. They don't put any energy into that. So they grow faster and they grow bigger and they may even live, they probably live longer because they don't put any of their energy into reproduction. So that's how this got started. The way they do it, there's a couple of different ways they can do it. They can either heat shock the eggs just after they're fertilized. They can use pressure to change them. There's a few different ways that they can use to change the number of chromosomes in the eggs and create
after they're fertilized, basically.
So after they're fertilized, yep. Yeah. Right after they're fertilized, they do something to the eggs, usually with heat or pressure to introduce these or to change the number of chromosomes. And so these fish do get huge. And there was an interesting controversy a while back. There were a couple of brothers, the Conrad brothers, and they had caught a fish in Canada in Lake Diefenbacher, which was the heaviest rainbow trout ever caught, the world record rainbow trout. Although, of course, people instantly trying to put an asterisk on that because this fish was probably a triploid rainbow trout that had escaped from a nearby fish farm into the lake. So that was a sort of another whole fascinating story. Should we count
the picture of that in your book?
Rainbow trout? Yeah, that is in the book. That's right.
Yeah.
should we count this? Oh, it's incredible. It's incredible. The belly on that thing.
Yeah.
So that was another interesting controversy that plays into this whole thing of what's native, what's not native, what's a synthetic fish, what's a real rainbow trout. No, it's another fascinating controversy.
There's a question from Bill Reeves in California. He says, what's your opinion on collecting wild trout as broodstock instead of hatchery and breeds and that they now use and in limiting stocking in urban areas?
So they do frequently bring in fish from the wild because anytime you've got fish in these hatcheries for too long, they run into a real inbreeding problem. So frequently they do catch fish in the wild and bring them in for the purposes of stocking. But it's a much more, on the flip side, you don't want to do that too many times because actually these fish that are in the hatcheries are well suited to the hatcheries. They do well in the hatcheries. And do you really want to go out and raid the sort of wild self-sustaining stocks for the sake of the hatcheries? There's a whole bunch of questions about it. So it is done at times, but usually if you keep a broodstock in these hatcheries where you have a sort of some knowledge about what they are. And what was the second part of the question?
He says, well, he's talking about instead of using that broodstock instead of hatchery breeds that they now use. Oh, and limiting stocking in urban areas. He's talking about limiting stocking.
Limiting stocking?
Yeah.
You mean less?
Yeah.
So, I'm not sure.
The question isn't real clear. Let's just skip it.
Okay.
Because if I can't deliver it to you, then you're not going to be able to answer it. So let's look at another one here. Kevin in Plainfield, Illinois, he talks about, is there such thing as a tiger rainbow trout? He says, in Wisconsin, there's a tiger brook trout, which is a mix of species.
Yeah, there are these mixes of species. There's no, quote, tiger trout, but there are some really fantastic fish that they've created. They have a fish that they frequently pass off as golden trout in some sort of those in some places, and they're not really a golden trout in the sense of the golden trout from California, the famous golden trout from California. They're instead this sort of albino golden rainbow trout that somebody found in a hatchery and thought would be a good sort of sensationalistic fish to put out in the wild. So there are some sort of spectacular strains out there. But there's no, quote, tiger rainbows. But they have done plenty of, all the way back to Seth Green, lots of experiments mixing these, well, not just all of the trout. The trout, for some reason, are very easy to hybridize, not even just within the same genus. You can actually hybridize them across from many different species. So they have done a lot of experiments with it. But mostly the rainbow trout that are out there are pure rainbow trout. They haven't, for some reason, that hasn't taken off.
Yeah, Rob in Atlanta asks, he says, just finished your book. He says, great book. He says, I work as a part-time guide in Georgia mountains in summers, and the summers are especially hard on rainbows being warmer down there, I guess. Any research on different strains that survive better in the south, and is the research available to the public? Because when you first said that, you said rainbows were native from Mexico to Kamchatka. That's a big temperature range, I would think, too.
Yeah. Well, so that's an interesting point that you raise. There is this thing called the National Fish Strain Registry, and they have all of these different rainbow trout strains rated for all sorts of different qualities, how hard they fight, how migratory they are, how well they withstand various diseases. And I'm not sure if they rate them on temperature, thermal tolerance, but it may well be in there. In any case, there is research on that out there, and I'm pretty sure you could probably get a hold of this National Fish Strain Registry through your library. Just go to WorldCat. Well, go to your local library and look it up, and they can probably get it for you.
There you go, Rob. Good. Well, finally, we need to wrap things up here, Anders, but I just wanted to throw out to you, what do you see, you know, in the raising of rainbow trout and hatcheries and so forth for the future? What can we expect to see down the road, either scary or enticing?
There are the scary things, but I think there's also, I think the world is, well, that's a tricky question. What do I see? There is the scary things that we have with the genetically modified fish coming out there. But clearly, the world of native trout has come into its own over the last few decades, and every state out there and every fish management agency out there is well aware of the need to maintain and, in some cases, restore these native trout. So what I think we're going to be seeing is probably less stocking of rainbow trout in many places where may interfere with any sort of where you have a wild or native fishery. So I'm sort of optimistic about that. On the flip side, you've got the genetically modified stuff coming along, and Lord knows what the world is going to look like when climate change has gotten done with things.
And that rapidly changing. Well, great. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and we need to wrap things up here, but stick with us, folks. We're going to talk with Anders just a bit more here. We're going to return and give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and a copy of Anders' book, An Entirely Synthetic Fish. So stick with us a few more minutes, and we'll do those giveaways, and somebody will be the winners. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon in the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from around the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's www.savebristolbay.org. And learn more about how you can get involved and help. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd surely appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away some prizes. The winners for our drawings tonight are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register already, then it's a little late now, but make sure you do that for the next show because we're always giving away some great prizes and you'll want to be involved and be a potential winner. So if you are a winner tonight, we will contact you after the show by email and provide you with information on how to receive your gifts. So be looking for that. Now, the first gift we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And a great organization to be part of and support. You want to learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And our winner there is James Midget, M-I Midget. And James is in Tennessee. So, James, congratulations on that. If you're already a member, we'll get you extended and enjoy your membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Now, secondly, we're going to give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and that is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada, an incredible magazine with excellent photography, and one you'll definitely enjoy reading as well. And there we have our winner is going to be Ralph, and Ralph Yassi, yes it is, and that's in Connecticut. Ralph's in Connecticut, so Ralph, congratulations on winning that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And if you want to find out more about Fly Fusion Magazine, go to www.flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Okay, Anders, we're going to give away your book here, and so I need to clear my cue here. Now, if you're going to participate in this, put your answer to the question in that text box on our homepage, and along with your name and your location, and the first person to answer this correctly will be the winner. So let's see here now. Two-part question. I've been doing two-part questions, Anders, because we just got to make it a little bit harder on these folks. So the first part of this question is, I'm going to make this pretty hard for them. First part is, what chemical was used in the Green River to kill all the fish? And second part is, what was the major hatchery operations and distribution point in California that gets credit for most of the stocking going on in the United States? Name of a river. So those two things, okay? Chemical that was used to kill the fish, and also the McLeod River. Okay, I got a answer here from Joel Wilson in Sheridan, Wyoming. And Anders, he says, Rhododendron and McLeod River. Is he correct?
I think we have to count it. It's Rotenone, Rotenone. But since we didn't spell it out on the show, I think that's
enough. That's a good enough. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Joel, you just won Anders' book. First one in, you got it right, and close enough by Anders' determination here. So congratulations. I know you're going to enjoy it. It's a really, I was telling Anders earlier before the show, I was surprised at what a nice read it was. It's interesting, historical, it's entertaining, and I found it just a joy to read, and I know you will. And anyone else, if you want to look for that book, it's called An Entirely Synthetic Fish by Anders Halvorsen. Look it up at your fly shop or Amazon, or go to Anders' site at www.andershalvorsen.com and find out more and see more pictures, as Anders said, as well there. Well, Anders, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. It was a pleasure talking to you and learn about a fish that we fish so much for and really didn't know much about until tonight. And I appreciate you sharing your knowledge.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, great. Thanks for being here. Our next show is going to be on July 6th. And 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. That show, we're going to interview Ralph Cutter, and our topic for the show will be fish food. Ralph Cutter literally wrote the book on fish food, and to write fish food, he donned his snorkeling gear and studied species underwater. So listen in to learn what Ralph has discovered about the food trout eat and why. It's sure to make you a better fly fisher. And we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, the Orvis Company, Cortland Line, the Trout Spot, and Front Range Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. Think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows? Give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.